Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. This is Mormon Stories. I'm John DeLynn. Today I'm very excited to bring to you an illustrious panel of people whom I very much admire to discuss the topic of raising children in the LDS Church when the parents are either semi-believers or unorthodox or even in some cases non-believers. That's the topic for today. And I have with us three very special guests. My first guest is Lee White. Hello, Lee.
Good evening.
I also have with us Heather Olson Beal. Hi, Heather.
Hey.
And my good friend, Lori Gallagher. Hi, Lori.
Hey there.
All right. So to begin with, I think it makes sense for each of us to kind of briefly explain where we're coming from. I think, you know, my audience pretty much knows where I'm coming from, but I'll just state it for the record. I consider myself to be a believer, but in a very general sense, kind of a Unitarian Universalist and kind of a pragmatist when it comes to Mormon doctrine and theology and stuff. But I'm definitely active in church. I believe that inspiration happens in the church. And my wife and I are definitely raising our children in the church. So that's where I come from. Why don't we just go around the horn, maybe starting with Heather. Maybe each of you could just talk a little bit about, you know, yourself. Just give us a quick high-level bio of who you are and what you do, and then talk about kind of what paradigm or framework you're coming from. So Heather, you go first, then Lori, then Lee.
Okay. I'm from Texas. I'm an education professor. I'm very Mormon. I was born and raised in the church, and everyone in my family and my husband's family is a member of the church. I've basically structured my life around the being a Mormon, and I'm very grateful for lots of experiences that I've had in the church. That said, I sort of consider myself a doubter, or a questioner at least, where I feel like I definitely have lots more questions than I have answers. And my kids, as my kids have gotten older, they are 7, 10, and 13. They apparently are questioners also, and they've asked me lots of questions that have caused me to, that have just given me pause. So, and my husband is in a similar position. Is that good enough?
That's awesome.
Okay.
Welcome, Heather.
Thanks.
All right, Laurie, you're next.
All right. I'm not a big fan of labels, but they're effective. So I would say that I'm a multi-generational Mormon. And I use the term Mormon. I feel very Mormon, but I'm a non-believer. I'm also an active yogi, and I'm really rich in my own spiritual pursuits. I have three kids, a 5-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 14-year-old. And I have a husband who is a believer who loves the church and wants to stay.
And tell us what a yogi is, for those who don't know.
Yoga practitioner. I'm a yoga teacher, and I have a yoga studio, and that's what I do from sunup to sundown. Yoga.
Wonderful.
What form of yoga? Namaste?
I studied Ashtanga, but I teach vinyasa flow. Yeah.
And if any of you know what that means, I'll give you an ice cream.
You owe me an ice cream, John.
Okay. All right, Lee. Okay, Lee. Well, thanks, Lori. Welcome. And Lee, you're next.
Lee White. I live in Seattle, Washington with my wife. We have four children, the youngest of which is 22 years of age. And he's a senior at Western Washington University, 90 miles north of here. I am a convert to the church, but my family has been involved in the church since the 1840s. So I was born in the covenant, but really never understood it, was not involved in the church in my teen years, and converted to it personally and spiritually when I was in my late teens, and have been active in the church ever since, but in a very unorthodox and non-traditional way. I teach the gospel doctrine class for adults in my ward, but I'm frequently found quoting from Zen scripture and Judaism, from the Torah and the Talmud, and occasionally from Friedrich Nietzsche.
Wow.
Awesome. And
which gets me in trouble,
right? Now,
I do find that the church has been a tremendous tool for enhancing spiritual growth and development with me, with my family. And that having been said, there have also been times when it has been a hindrance.
And Lee, I hope I'm not asking you to repeat yourself, but did you tell us how many of your kids have remained active and versus not?
My three daughters are active in the church to varying degrees, and
as adults,
As adults,
yeah.
My son, my 22-year-old son, has not been involved in the church and does not define himself as a Latter-day Saint currently.
And I think it's important, Lee, just to say, you know, for those of us whose kids are, you know, in the primary years or in the teen years, for those of us who would ask ourselves, can you be sort of a non-traditional, unorthodox Mormon and raise kids in a healthy, constructive way where they can achieve adulthood and maybe even remain in the church, but still have that be a positive and even a constructive experience? You know, you're kind of here saying so far, for you, it's been a good decision. Is that right?
It's been a great decision. I have rich conversations with all four of my kids and now my grandkids on a fairly regular basis about making doubt and questioning what goes on with church traditions and even doctrines a vibrant part of faith. And those are exciting conversations. In fact, I spend more time talking with my son about how to deflect and really raise questions with active Latter-day Saints who are mainstream, who are questioning why he's not involved, why he didn't go on a mission, why he's not getting engaged now, and how they can help him get to that. And I talk to him a lot about how to reflect his own core values, his spiritual path, and his beliefs in conversations with them through asking powerful questions.
Excellent. Well, we'll definitely get to that as we get to the later parts of the sort of chronology of an upbringing of a child. So Lee, welcome to Mormon Stories. And again, thank you all for joining in. I guess I'd like to begin with a question that may catch some of you guys off guard because we didn't talk about this. But the first question that I think may occur to some people, and it would just be some, is this question of, if you are not a literal believer, if you're a parent and you're a semi-believer or, you know, struggling or even a non-believer, would the church itself even want you to stay in the church or to raise your kids within it? You know, some people might go, well, before I even consider doing it, I need to make sure that I'm wanted here. And I don't know if any of you have any personal experience with higher levels of church leadership where you could speak to that. But I do have a story or two, but let me throw it out to you guys first. Do any of you guys have a thought or a comment on that, whether the church would even want us to be doing what we're doing? I'll start with Heather.
I don't have any experience with higher leadership, except for my dad. My dad has had several callings. And so I can't say, well, I heard this or I was in this conversation, but I would have to say, yes, they would want us. Otherwise, I don't think I could continue in this path. I mean, I just have to think that there would be some recognition that, you know, Heavenly Father loves all of us regardless of where we are sort of on that belief spectrum. I don't know. Perhaps that's naive, but that's the way I feel.
Well, that's very good. Laurie, do you have a thought on that question?
You know, being that's something that I should probably feel the most because I noticed before my big disaffection that I just started to feel like a non-believer amidst everybody that I grew up with who, you know, I started to feel like the non-member of the group. And I, you know, I've come to the conclusion that it doesn't really matter where I'm wanted. It doesn't really change the fact that I am Mormon and that I need to decide where I want to be.
Right.
So that's my path, is listening to my own inner voice and not listening to other people's. And I met with my bishop, and I didn't give him really any chance to discuss that with me.
Right.
I had clear boundaries on that one.
Good. All right, Lee, before I launch into a story, do you have any additional thoughts you want to add?
Yeah, I think your question is a great one, and it really gets to the heart of how well do Latter-day Saints teach tolerance and inclusion beyond ethnic, cultural, and kind of national orientation, and beyond that, diversity of thought, diversity of action, and diversity of belief. I've experienced the extremes, not much in the middle. Examples of that. Marilyn and my wife and I are very good friends with Jack and Linda Newell. When Linda Newell was writing her book Mormon Enigma on the life of Emma Smith, my wife was the individual largely involved in typing the manuscript and even offering some editorial comment about how the book laid out. And the church put a sanction on Linda speaking in firesides wards throughout the church. They would have preferred that the book go away. I went to my bishop and said, because I was in the bishopric at the time, and said, this woman has written this terrific book about the prophet's wife. Can we have her come and speak in church? He had no question about it. And when I informed him that there had been a sanction against Linda speaking in church congregations about this, he said, well, I didn't get the memo, therefore, if you tell me it's inspiring, then I'll believe you because I trust you and we'll go ahead and go with it. So wow. That's a pretty good indicator of my experience with the extremes of tolerance and inclusiveness in the church. And have I ever been ostracized or told that I'm not welcome in the church? Yeah, I have, but more for my political affiliation recently than anything else. My organization does a lot of advocacy work on healthcare reform. I don't need to say anything else.
All right. Okay, great. Well, I'll just throw this in, and I have to be careful how I say this, but listeners will know that I spent a lot of time trying to help people work through this and see people struggle a lot. So through some channels, and I have to be vague about everything that I'm saying by the request of the people that are involved, but through some channels, I've been able to have, let's just say, some conversations with people whom you would know their name, who are, let's just say at leadership levels, maybe even high leadership levels in the church. And I've asked this question point blank. Are we wanted? Are semi-believers or non-literal believers wanted or not wanted? And the very explicit and clear sense that I've been given is that the answer is absolutely yes. And I was even explicit in saying, what if we don't necessarily believe in a literal book of, historical Book of Mormon? What if we question the anthropomorphic God? What if we struggle with the literalness of the atonement? And there was no flinching involved. There was no chastisement or rebukement involved. It was unequivocally, we want you in the church. And it came at such a high level that I'm comfortable saying that, for those who feel like they want to try and make it work, I feel enough confidence telling you that at least among some of those top leaders, there is an absolute hope that people will consider it. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone's going to make that choice or that even I'm advocating that everyone makes that choice. But I did want to lay that out there as something that people should know. And I'm sorry I can't be more explicit, but, you know, I have to respect the people who've asked me to kind of be tactful. So I will. So let's go on to one of the first and most interesting questions that I think we're going to know the answer to very quickly. Laurie, I think it was you who asked the question very early on. Let's say that we're not believing or struggling or unorthodox. There is the option of just faking it, of just pretending throughout your life that you do believe everything and you do everything and ignoring whatever doubts or questions or problems you have. Now, Laurie, you didn't seem hip on that idea, so why don't you be the first to kind of talk about that?
Well, it goes right into what you were just saying. There's this dichotomy between knowing that people want you there, but why? You know, do they want to save you? Do they believe you can't get to heaven without this gospel? But they're not necessarily welcoming of you asking questions about Joseph's wives in Relief Society, you know? So it puts you as a questioner or somebody struggling or a non-believer in an awkward position when you attend. So personally, there's no question for me. There's no way for me to fake it. There's no way for me to fake it. And as far as we're talking about children, I believe that kids know when you're faking it. They know when you're faking it. And it's much healthier, in my opinion, to just say, I don't know, than to fake it. Okay. That makes sense?
Sure. Okay. Lee, I'll let you take a stab at that question next.
I have trouble with the notion that I can remain in the church and remain involved, even though I don't believe, and I'm doing it because there are good values taught, and I want to do it for my kids. When your kids grow up and find out that you were engaged in that kind of vague response to your spiritual beliefs and your religious beliefs, I think you're in trouble. I think you're inviting some difficulty. I think there's richness in engaging kids in conversations about the validity and almost the necessity of questioning things. I've talked to my kids a whole lot about the foundations of the church. Really, the church got started with a 14-year-old kid questioning, doubting his religious framework and seeking help. Whether you believe in the literalness of Joseph Smith's experience or not, you recognize that this young kid started out in a place of questioning. And are we not like him in a sense that we should be questioning virtually every action of our life and every principle that the church puts out there, and finding out how can we assimilate this or challenge it from our spiritual experience as well as our religious experience? I make that distinction between spiritual and religious intentionally.
Sure. And I want to ask Heather the next question, but I just want to highlight what you just said, Lee. There are a lot of people who, once they start digging into the history, get frustrated with Joseph Smith and some of the things that he did that are, you know, discouraging to some. But I remember something that Joanna Brooks said, which also reflects what you just said, which is that what a glorious legacy we have in just that one founding story of a boy who questions and seeks and finds truth, and the basic teaching that each of us, and this is a Mormon teaching, it's a very Mormon teaching, that each one of us has the responsibility to seek spiritually confirmations for what we believe and know to be right. So that, I think that is a legacy of Mormonism that we can proudly sort of stand up and admire regardless of where we are on the spectrum, although I know that mixed messages are sometimes given. But Heather, why don't you jump in and add anything that you feel comfortable adding to what's been said?
Well, so we're talking about whether you can fake it or whether we would want to.
Either to the ward or to your children, yeah.
Well, when I hear that, I the first thing I thought was, well, what does it mean to fake it? Because I feel like, I mean, are we talking about behaviors or are we talking about discussions about belief, because I suppose that my kids could look at me, as Lee said, and maybe look, I mean, I've wondered this once I get older and think, well, if my mom didn't know for sure that all these things are true, why did we go to church every Sunday? Why did we obey the word of wisdom? Why did we pay tithing? Why did we, you know, the list, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then possibly they could think that I was faking it if they somehow find out later that I wasn't sure. But I feel like then to counter that, I try to just tell them lots of times, I don't know. So, you know, speaking of Joseph Smith, for instance, my daughter read all the Work in the Glory books when she was about 10.
Wow.
Yes. And so this was 3 or 4 years ago. She completely freaked out when she read some of the stuff in there about polygamy and came to me. And that is something that probably 5 and for sure 10 and 15 and 20 years ago was very difficult for me. It's not really anymore. But she came to me and was just incensed and actually said, Joseph Smith is an idiot. And I said, well, you know, and she was asking me, what do you think? And I thought, well, this is sort of a defining moment because she's asking me a question that for many years has been has sort of haunted me. And I just said, I don't know. I can't explain why some of those things happened. We weren't there. We didn't see it. This has been something that's always really hard for me. And I just said, I don't know. And I have to sort of hope that my kids accept that answer or that they appreciate my honesty and not think my mom was faking it.
Right. That's really good. Well, I'll just add my 2 cents. And that's that one thing that's very, very common when someone starts down the disillusionment or disaffection process, or let's just say stage 4 foul or whatever you want to call it, where they're in that dark night of the soul, but they haven't quite told everybody yet, pressure starts to build inside of them. And there's this dynamic where they're going to church and trying to be quiet, or their wife's teaching family home evening and they're trying to be quiet. And the pressure begins to mount and build inside of them in very, very powerful ways, to the point where just a sacrament meeting, a testimony given, or something said by a spouse can lead to an explosion of frustration because the person who's struggling has been trying to keep so much in and hide things. And I'll just say that I have not seen the decision to sort of hide and to fake things be very sustainable. I've mm-hmm. seen it on the flip side lead to anger and rage and unhealthy sort of extreme reactions. And so I come down on the side of saying that over time, there are people in the short to medium term who for practical reasons or personal reasons just have to hide and fake it. And the church is full of people like that. Not full of, but let's just say there are thousands or more of people like that in the church who do fake it. But I haven't seen that be successful in the medium to long run. I see it as potentially very counterproductive. And the last thing I'll just add is the last thing I could ever want or feel good about is having my kid go through, you know, having me taught my kid to be a true believing, non-doubting, Orthodox, traditional Mormon, have them go through their own crisis of faith and then turn to me and say, you knew this all along and you didn't tell me, and have them have made decisions without a bit of a more full knowledge that I could have imparted to them early. Now, I'm not saying spoil the myth and poison the well from the start. I'm not saying that. But I do. I have felt like I needed to be as honest as is healthy and constructive for my children and for my spouse and for my family. So that's where I come down.
And John?
Laurie, then Lee.
I just wanted to add that there's a difference between faking it and keeping something personal while you're processing it. There's a lot of talk about, you know, this New Order Mormon lifestyle of faking it and how it doesn't work. But when you're first trying to figure things out, you don't know who you can share with. And that can also be an authentic place to be, a quiet processing.
That's very good. And you don't want to burn bridges before you kind of know where you're going to stand.
Sure.
Yeah. Lee, what were you going to add?
As one whose kids are largely launched, what I've experienced with my kids is more this. They come to me in their late teen or early adulthood years and they say, Dad, why didn't you ever really explain this problem with polygamy that the church has experienced for a couple of hundred years now? And didn't you ever doubt it? And I engaged them in a terrific conversation. And, you know, what they were typically putting in front of me is, I have this conversation with this person I love, this very rational human being who has disaffected from the church because they have come to discover that the church has portrayed a history and an experience that isn't quite represented by fact. And so it creates cognitive dissonance. Dad, help me understand this. And instead of saying, no, put it aside, I say, yes, I've experienced that. And let me get you other resources that might help you. Here's the Bachman thesis. Why don't you read this? And then let's have a conversation about it. And here's an article by Henry Eyring that talks about his doubts after having struggled with the issue of polygamy when he was a young man that we also want to have a conversation about. So let's stay in the question and deal with the ambiguity of this in the way that we deal with so many other things that are non-religious and non-spiritual, things that might relate to our competencies about how we do our jobs or educate ourselves or even experience our relationships with one another. There are no black and whites in so many things that we look at and say, yes, it's obvious that this is black and white. There is no gray.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah.
But Lee, in speaking to what you just said, would you say, I feel like that, I mean, what you're saying I think is great, but I don't feel like that's really encouraged by the church. I mean, I just opened our Friend magazine last week for April or March, I can't remember, and there was a whole page on it, and the very top of the page it said, "We do not doubt." And I felt sad reading that because and like you said, John, I guess, what a great story that we have about Joseph Smith who did doubt.
Yeah,
and so somehow
right.
It does seem like that is really being discouraged. We do not doubt.
Yeah. One of the huge contradictions, isn't it?
What?
It's one of the huge contradictions I think we face in the church, that once you enter the realm of mainstream Mormonism, it's like somebody expects you to turn off the switch and no longer question doubt. I've had bad experiences with that, and I've had good experiences with it. But largely, when I can put my concern and my constructive questions and beliefs in front of someone who is trying to recognize that this community of faith is much broader than we might have originally thought, it engages and invites more open, honest, authentic conversation than, nope, you're expressing doubt and we do not doubt as a people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think in theory we're in a tough place with that, but I think in practice, more often than not, my experience with people is, if you have trust and you come at that from a place of love, there is an invitation for openness, and at the very worst, you end up saying, we're going to agree to disagree about this.
Mm-hmm.
Heather, the only thing I'll add, just for people who are seeking a ray of hope, I guess, if you want to find, I think we're all in agreement that doubt is discouraged and stigmatized within the church, but I don't think that that's the only story. I think we all know 10 or 20 quotes from Brigham Young or Joseph Smith or whoever that say, doubt, question everything, don't believe a thing I say, make sure you believe it. I mean, I do think that we can reach back into our heritage and legacy and see that there have been moments and quotes and comments. You can just take Hubie Brown alone as a member of the First Presidency or even David O. McKay and see that eschewing doubt is not the only message that's been conveyed within Mormonism, and mm-hmm. we can bring that forward. But also, I would just add that the pendulum swings, and if I had to assess where the doubt pendulum is right now, it's swinging towards a realization that skepticism is going is raging and is going to be raging. And if you look at either the Joseph Smith Papers Project or the book, the Deseret book Selling Rough Stone Rolling, or the Mountain Meadows Massacre book that the church produced, or the tendency of the church now to address the really tough articles in the Ensign and in the church news, I think the church is trying to manage this this sort of inswell of doubting. And even if you look at the Mormon Times, which is published online, and it's also published via the Deseret News, but every week on Thursday in the Mormon Times, you have the church trying to tackle some of these tough questions. Now, admittedly, it's often an apologetic response. But I think, for me at least, I think the momentum is moving towards a realization that skepticism and curiosity and doubt are a reality that the brethren are just going to have to figure out how to come to grips with. Can any of you guys buy that, or you guys think I'm full of crud?
I think that's very hopeful. I do. I mean, I certainly would not think that, you know, the Friend magazine would be an appropriate venue, you know, to tease that out. I mean, that seems like something much better done, you know, in a family setting or one-on-one. But just to see that, I thought it was sad, because it does seem like it's totally contrary to what the founding story of our church is. I mean, we'll have the primary kids saying, you know, my kids when they were 3 and 4 could tell the story about how Joseph Smith was reading, you know, in James, and he didn't know how he felt, and so he went to pray. And so it is a bit disturbing to me to have that story and to see something that's the most current thing there is saying, yeah, we do not doubt. And I just on Sunday got up and bore my testimony, a testimony of nothingness almost, but because I actually said I'm a doubter, and so I'm not here to testify of the truthfulness of anything, because I feel like I have lots more questions than I have answers, like I said at the beginning.
I think you're in good company, Heather. I think you can say, just like my brother Joseph Smith was a doubter.
Maybe so, but I was very surprised afterwards, because numerous people came up to me and thanked me for my honesty. So it did sort of make me wonder, you know, maybe there are more people, and it's just really not cool to say that, you know? It's not cool to admit that.
Well, let's definitely acknowledge that we're in a tough spot in terms of the way doubt is talked about. And let's, you know, to the extent that we decide to, let's put our hats of hope on that maybe we can do our small part to make it better. How's that sound?
All right, sure.
Okay, well, but I think this is a great segue into the topic of raising children more specifically. And what I'd like to do is start sort of chronologically. So the primary experience, who feels like they would best like to characterize the challenges with raising kids of primary age that our listeners also might empathize with? Who wants to take a stab? I can start.
Laurie? I'll start.
Okay, Laurie.
You know, I have the 5-year-old and the 10-year-old, and their stages of development are, you know, it's very hard to teach them symbolism and myth and all of those things, because they want it black and white. They need it black and white. So as a non-believer, you know, I can freak out because they're learning, you know, they're singing the song, Follow the Prophet, you know, or we can teach what does the prophet teach and focus on the good things that he teaches rather than taking the emphasis on that. And you teach them in your own way to start to look for nuances. They can get it. They can get it in real subtle little ways.
But Laurie, what are the and you mentioned the exact obedience one. If you had to list some of the other messages that you don't love or that sometimes really don't like at all that are taught in primary, let's just list them just so that we can all get on the same page. Are there any you want to add? I can add some. Heather, you might have some.
Oh, I would say that anybody that doesn't follow the word of wisdom is bad. I mean, that's definitely
right. Yep.
The child would see it.
Yep.
That it's there's one way to heaven. There's yep. one way to heaven, and I have to be good to get there.
Right.
Help me out here.
How about gays are bad?
Yeah.
That might be a message that some get, some, you know, picked up along the way.
And damaging is this non-example for the girls. Non-example mm-hmm. for the girls. There's no women in any authority position. None.
None. No picture. No pictures of women on the walls of primary.
No. No. And they may see a primary president standing up there. And again, it goes back to the truth. I think they know she has to follow a program. There's no power there.
Right.
So that's damaging.
Lee, you were going to jump in. Let's keep with this theme of talking about what's hard, and then we'll talk about how we deal with it. Did you have something you want to add, Lee?
Yeah, I was just struck by Laurie's comment about follow the prophet. Just as an aside, does anybody ever listen to that and think that that's more appropriate as a Halloween song? just the melody.
I've heard it characterized as appropriate for much worse, I'll say that.
Moving on.
Heather, did you want to add anything?
I like to sing it at our house with our arms out front like a zombie following.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, I'm sorry.
How about the recent song about the mother's role and the father's role?
Don't get me started.
Well, just describe, just for our listeners, just describe what was hard for you about that, Heather. Just let me get you started. Not because we're griping, but because we're trying to get on the same page.
I'm actually the primary chorister, so... I love it. So even listen, when you ask that question, what are some hard things about primary? Despite all of my issues, that's a hard question for me to answer. I mean, I can hear the answers that other people give and see that, but I so love primary. I love myself to be in there, and I think that my kids have had very, very good experiences. So that's actually a hard question for me to answer. But regarding that song, I had a very hard time because I really don't like the characterization or the oversimplification of divine gender roles. So the fact that we had a whole month last year where we were supposed to talk about the responsibilities of fathers and the responsibilities of mothers, and the curriculum was written using, you know, quotes from the Family Proclamation, and that song was also. So there are quotes and sentences pulled directly from the Family Proclamation. So I understand why it was used as a source, but I have a very hard time with it. And worried about how I was going to do it. And I worried about what my kids would think if I did it, talking about faking it. I actually thought that my kids would like out me and say, "What are you talking about, Mom?" You know? So I actually just emailed the three members of the primary presidency and said, I can't teach that song for those 2 weeks. Where I taught the first verse and I taught the fourth verse. And I skipped the 2 weeks when we taught the second verse and the third verse, because those are the ones that talk about father's roles and mother's roles. So I was happy actually to see that. I kind of worried about it because I thought, what are these people going to do when I tell them I can't teach this song? And they didn't do anything. They just said, one of them actually emailed back and said, "Well, we definitely don't want you to have to do something that you don't feel comfortable with. So we'll take care of it."
That's a good story.
So, yeah, that's a hard, the gender role thing is hard. And last year it was hard because the curriculum was all about eternal families, which is good on one side. But if you're anything other than a mom and a dad married in the temple, then I think that message, which for some people is very good, for other people is very difficult to swallow. And actually, when we taught that song, I cut out pictures from the friend of all different races of people and ages and different family groups, and some with a mom and a kid, and some that had siblings, and some with just a dad. And I gave every kid in the primary a stick that had a different picture on it. And when we sang that song, each of them held up their different family. And so I did that to try to make for myself, to try to make me feel better. And I said many points during that year, and especially during that month, everybody's family looks different, and Heavenly Father loves us to be in families, but everyone's doesn't look the same. And raise your hand if your family that you're holding looks like your real family, and no one's did, you know. So again, I don't know if anyone thought that was crazy or not, but I liked it.
It's terrific.
It's such a good example of creating your own power and taking it back and saying, I have jurisdiction over what we sing. So let's make this work. You know, I've been in primaries where we haven't learned certain songs and nobody's noticed.
Right.
They've been skipped over. But I like that you found a way to do it and include everybody.
But you didn't go for the two daddies or the two mommies, right, Heather? You showed some restraint.
Well, okay. Well, so let's say I had. But for real, you're laughing, and I thought about it, and Brent asked me if I was going to do that, and I said, you know, I'm not, because that will ruin it.
Yeah.
I don't want anyone to think that I'm not saying that, but that message was very well received by the adults that were in the room, I think. And right. One woman who actually told me that she and her husband's former wife were very good friends. And anyway, she was talking about how she had a very non-traditional family. And she told me she was grateful, very grateful for the lesson and the way I had taught it. But as soon as I had said, and look at this picture that has two moms and a kid or two dads, everyone's ears would have been closed. So I know better than to... I mean, that would have been spending too much capital, I'm afraid.
Yeah, that's good. That's very good. Well, I'm going to draw a line just starting from my own experience, because I do think, you know, Laura, you bring up a good question about how much nuance and how much symbolism and metaphor can kids take. But I'm going to start by telling you guys, offering where we've drawn our lines. When my second daughter was 4 years old, we read her out of the illustrated Old Testament, and we read her the story of Noah. And when we got done with the story, Maya says to me, "Now, Daddy, God created all those people, right?" "Yep." And Daddy, God created all those animals, right?" "Yep, yep, he sure did. And he loves all of us, right?" And we're like, "Yep." And then she said, "Well, why did he go and kill them all then?"
And smart girl.
I kind of had to make a decision right then that one place where I'm going to draw the line is ever teaching my children that God ever does a mean or a hateful or what I would consider to be an unchristlike thing. And yes, there will be moments where you have to say, we don't believe that the scriptures always... are completely accurate, that sometimes the scriptures reflect the point of view of the people who are writing it, or sometimes they make a little bit of mistakes, or even just simply saying to an 8-year-old, or even a 5-year-old, "Mommy and Daddy don't necessarily believe that story exactly the way it's said. We don't believe God would be mean or harmful to people." And that's a line where we definitely choose to draw it. In other words, we kind of reject openly the Old Testament God, and we sort of create God in the image we want to, which is a love and accepting God. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. I'm just going to throw out a couple things, then I want each of you guys to add or take away or respond to. A second thing that we just won't ever teach is superiority. So we teach our kids, we proactively teach our kids that people who drink coffee and smoke are good people, and we are in no way better than them on that axis. And we feel like we proactively do that. We do that with homosexuality as well. We proactively teach even our 6-year-old or 8-year-old that we love people who are gay. We don't see them as lesser than, and they are to be loved and accepted just like Jesus would. And then finally, I'm going to add, we overtly teach our children that our church is in no way superior to anyone else's church, that we have some good things. Maybe there are some things about our church that are better, but there are other churches that have things that are better than ours, and there are people who don't believe in churches at all that are awesome. And we definitely proactively teach our kids to not create this hierarchy of superiority where they think that they're ever better than anybody. And those are some places where we feel like, even with 5-year-olds, you can draw the line, and we can't do otherwise based on our conscience. So I'm going to throw it to Lee, and then Laurie, and then Heather, to either talk about adding, subtracting, or commenting on how they've handled things or would handle things. So Lee.
Thanks, John. Boy, I really appreciate the salient comments you make about how you put a framework of spirituality in front of your kids. Let me play off of that a little bit, because I had a couple of experiences in raising my kids when they were younger that might inform this conversation. When my oldest daughter, who was born in 1975, came to me when she was 6-7 years old, after primary, she said, "Dad, they had a picture up on the wall, and they had the picture of the devil on the left-hand side and picture of Christ on the right-hand side. And on the left-hand side, under the devil, they had coffee, tea, tobacco, and alcohol. On the right-hand side, they had fruits, vegetables, a loaf of bread, a Snicker bar." And she wanted to, and the conversation was, as you described, people who use these items are evil. People who use these items under Christ are good, wholesome Latter-day Saints or about to be Latter-day Saints. And she wanted some grounding. So my comment is about how you help your kids ground the experience in their religion with the reality of what we really hope and aspire that they begin to believe as core values in their lives. And with Lisa, with my other kids, we had conversations with them every time they came home and talked about Word of Wisdom primary or young women's lessons. So as young kids, you know, fortunately, the conversation with my daughter when she was 6, 7 years old happened the day after we had my boss from Washington, D.C. come in, and we served him an alcoholic drink and wine and got him some tea at the end of the evening. And we did that as a routine with our friends and families. My kids knew that I was a fairly chronic iced tea drinker. So in the contradiction, they wanted to know, how do we ground this religious experience with what we know to be the true way of living in our family? And as they became teenagers, I felt comfortable talking to them more fully about the evolution of the Word of Wisdom in the history of the church, how Brigham Young, even in their teens, how Brigham Young had the best stock liquor cabinet west of St. Louis for many, many years, and would entertain people like Richard Burton and Mark Twain and others, and would not just offer them drinks, but would drink with them. And that amazed them, and it also gave them a sense that, this is an evolving belief and practice in the church. And then when they became young adults and had questions about the Word of Wisdom, it was a different conversation. Read the 89th section of the Doctrine and Covenants again. When it says, not by way of commandment, but by way of advice or an admonishment for moderation, a word of wisdom, if you will, they got a different framework. Does it mean that they disbelieved it or they didn't practice it anymore? No, but they realized the truth can set them free. The other issue that we dealt with a whole lot was the whole notion of the trite phrase, the one and only true church. The kids never heard me utter it, even when I would bear my testimony in Sunday school classes or even at home with discussions about what we really did believe. I struggle with the phraseology, and they also know that there are many, many good things in other religions. We've experienced Shabbat with a lot of our Jewish friends. I've taken my kids to Zen temples before, and my kids know that I engaged in Zazen a number of times. My wife and I, many years ago, got fed up with an Easter sermon in sacrament meeting on missionary work and St. Paul's Episcopal Church, so we could experience the Stations of the Cross with our Episcopal brothers and sisters. My concluding point is, from the very moment we knew we wanted to have kids and we started having kids, we decided that we wanted spirituality and overarching good core values as human beings to be the end to which we aspire for ourselves and our kids, and the church can be a great tool for that. We never set out to teach our kids to be good Latter-day Saints as an end unto itself. Therefore, we are not a doubting people, never entered into the realm of their existence, because questioning how you get to that end of being an ethical individual who has very strong self-identity and strong self-confidence became an overarching issue for them, and doubt and question became an integral part of that.
That's good stuff. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.